This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Over these weeks on this program, we're featuring important American composers, alternating weeks with great instrumentalists, conductors, and singers. This week is a composer week, and we'll chat with the Long Island-born Christopher Cerrone. He studied at the Manhattan School of Music and has now been building a career, locating himself in Brooklyn, that includes numerous awards, and he was a finalist for the 2014 Pulitzer. He really raised interest and eyebrows with the performance of his opera Invisible Cities, presented in Los Angeles at Union Station, an opera experience that happened in public amongst commuters rushing and angling for their trains. His music ranges from string quartets — you're listening to the final minutes of his work for that venerable ensemble called Can't and Won't, which began life as a song cycle based on texts of one of my guest's favorite authors, Lydia Davis, and was commissioned by the Los Angeles Philharmonic and performed here by some of its string players, to concertos. His violin concerto with soloist Jennifer Coe is being premiered at the end of this month with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra led by Leonard Slatkin, to works utilizing the latest technology. He's also active in promoting not only his music, but new music in general. He's part of a composer's collective called Sleeping Giant, six young composers, including past Cadenza guest Timo Andrus and Ted Hearn, and oh my guest, he's only 34 years old. I spoke with Christopher Cerrone at his apartment in Brooklyn a few weeks back.
Here with the composer Christopher Cerrone. Don't mean to do this to you off the bat, but I'm going to start this night. It's not slotting you or having you be a spokesman, but you kind of represent two things as we sit here, which is you're in your 30s,
mm-hmm.
and you live in Brooklyn.
I'm in my mid-30s, officially.
Yes,
I'm 34. You're in mid-30s.
And many of our listeners, this might be an introduction to you and to your music. And I'm just curious, not that you'd be a spokesman, but I want to take, since what I just said is kind of a wheelhouse of a lot of musical activity going on right
mm-hmm.
now. So let's start with the age, because composers of your age are bringing a lot into their music, a lot of influences, a lot of technology, that even composers a generation past you, some of whom you studied with, mm-hmm. Bresnik and Lang and even Ezra Lyderman, people like this, didn't, or brought different, or used it different ways.
Right.
So, again, not that you're a spokesman for your slot here, but talk about what composers of your age group are bringing in that really makes this pretty exciting.
Well, I would be remiss to represent my generation, in as much as that I think people my age are doing a really huge variety of things, from traditional orchestral music to electroacoustic music to music that just sounds like a radiator.
right.
And so I would say that to me, the things that seem to mark our generation are the fact that we grew up with the internet. You know, I probably got my first AOL account in middle school. And I think in terms of what that means musically is that we grew up, you know, I got Napster in high school, and the dissemination of music was extremely wide from a young age. And so, you had access to so much music. And I think that that really is a hallmark of the influences that play very strongly on composers. I mean, I think there are very few people in my generation who grew up predominantly with classical music. I think they grew up predominantly with pop music. And the ability to sort of access all of this was, I think, you know, legitimately, there was a turning point in our generation where you had access to so much music, and that's...
I mean, you're all approaching it differently, but if you have that much access, when you get to the old Stravinsky thing, how do you know what to filter it, let come through the filter, and how what not? And then you're all doing it, making different decisions that way.
Yeah, but... I mean, for me also, I think that my relationship with technology is, like, a huge aspect of the work that I do, and It's funny because I feel that the relationship with the technology is the same, whether it's a string quartet for four acoustic instruments, whether it's a piece for piano electronics, whether it's an opera inside a train station. It's like all these things seem to, the composition process seems inimically related to the technology that, you know, I've had a personal computer my whole life, basically, since I was in middle school or younger. You know, and a lot of how I compose involves technology. So I think the relationship of the means towards writing, first of all, and second of all, I think the sound world of the music is very connected to the recording medium and also to how the music is composed.
Which is interesting because the whole other end of the business, we were just talking about recordings, that's all completely changed from what composers of an older generation knew and expected and wanted or tried for. The other thing, and I have no facts to back this up, but these days facts don't matter anyway, so it's cool. I can just Brooklyn just seems to be, not just music, but the art, it's such a hotbed. There's probably more new art being created, and if we just stick with music, just in this borough of New York City in the last, I'm going to say 10 years, maybe a little bit more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, none of us can afford to live in Manhattan. you know, as you've trekked out here to Flatbush.
Yeah. But there's also places and artists who are living here who are working together. And we're going to get to some of the people you're working with and all
of
that.
Of course,
stuff,
yeah. No, I mean, it does sort of seem like, because, you know, I went to school at the Manhattan School of Music.
Right.
And I lived uptown. And I remember one day I sort of like trekked out to Brooklyn. And I was like, oh my God, it's so cool. There's so much cool stuff here. So I think that, yeah, I mean, most of my friends who are my colleagues live in Brooklyn and there's all these places that are sort of touchstones within Brooklyn, whether it's National Sawdust, which is relatively new, whether it's Roulette, whether it's Issue Project Room, whether it's, you know, more like, you know, my friends did a show last night in one of their apartments. And so there's still a lot of, like, there's just a hotbed of activity all over the place. And
I mean, I'm not going to make comparisons, but... I mean, you think of like Paris and Berlin in the first part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Were just hotbeds of a lot of new creative ideas happening.
Or like Soho in the 70s, you know.
True, yeah. Yeah, but then you still have the uptown, downtown thing going on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think the uptown and the downtown people all live in Brooklyn now.
You mentioned, you know, technology, da-da-da, but studied in Manhattan. But how did you... Music to composition. I mean, what were you playing and what got you on the path of creating?
I think I've been basically creating music in some way or another my whole life for as long as I've played an instrument. I found a little piece I wrote when I was five when I was first composing called The Angry Song, and, you know, I had a forte part with half steps. But I think, you know, I grew up in suburban New York on Long Island, and I think that my upbringing was pretty, like, standard in terms of what my musical interests were. You know, I got very into rock music, you know, I played electric guitar, then electric guitar. I mean, I studied on piano first and foremost, classically, and have been playing piano since I was like 5 or 6 years old. Yeah, but then got seduced by the electric guitar, seduced by the electric bass. Eventually, weirdly came full circle and took up the upright bass and joined an orchestra. And yeah, I had a very strange, circuitous path towards classical music in that I've been studying it my whole life. But weirdly, I literally sort of rebelled my way into classical music because I was, you know, into alternative rock and punk rock and hardcore and experimental rock and, you know, jazz and listening to these, you know, modal jazz records. And I was playing jazz as well in high school, and at some point I was like, whoa, Beethoven, you know, what is this? And I got sort of obsessed with the idea of long form music, which is something that I think is still, like, you know, I think it's what composers of classical, contemporary music, whatever you want to call it, it's sort of the thing we can do. We can do a thing where you see it live and it's 20 minutes long, it's 30 minutes long, and it's one continuous thing. And what's so appealing to me is that I put on these, you know, Beethoven symphonies and was riveted for 45 or 50 minutes straight in a way that was just, I was like, that's what I want to do. You know, I got it in my head very clearly.
My guest, composer Christopher Cerrone, composes works that reflect his surroundings and environment, from his work called Memory Place that carries movements of places in and around the New York City region, to his work for solo piano and electronics composed for pianist and past Cadenza guest Vicky Chow, named after a subway stop on the Brooklyn G Line, Hoyt Skirmerhorn, and according to the composer, a tribute to the New York nightscape. Here is Vicky in the final minutes of that work.
Even just a little bit into this interview, you've heard, the audience has heard, the influences you brought in as you got older. Now you rediscover classical music long-form composition. How do you rectify that? I mean, because you're not above some of your pieces reflect your surroundings and what you see. And
yeah, I think it actually took me a really long time to become comfortable with myself. Yeah. You know, in that I think, you know, I'm from this suburban past and, you know, I just sort of decided, you know, there's something about becoming a classical composer, which is the most unsuburbs thing you can possibly do. You know, I sort of imagined a culture that did exist because I was growing up very close to New York, but the suburbs themselves are kind of devoid of any kind of notion of culture. It's sort of capitalism replaces the culture, and you have strip malls and you have stores, but there was no I guess there was a symphony on Long Island, but it wasn't, yeah. I wasn't aware of it. And, you know, there were museums, but there weren't museums like the Met. And, you know, I think it's because I grew up in this place which sort of tacitly knew that the cultural center of the world was an hour away, so that you didn't actually have any of it in this place. So in a sense, I like looked over to New York and saw it, but it wasn't actually part of my daily life at all growing up. And
right.
So, you know, my parents are like good cultured people, but, you know, they're not like literati or anything. So, you know, a lot of it was a process of discovery. And I think that that's actually maybe the thing that appealed to me the most when I was young was seeing this thing that was sort of like off on the horizon of this kind of culture or art. And it just seemed so cool and beautiful to me. So, you know, I think I became very purist for a while. When I was like turned 18, I stopped listening to pop music for like 5 years and only listened to classical music and knew I had sort of a hole. I didn't, you know, I'd studied, you know, I had a nice piano teacher in high school and I had a music theory teacher in high school who really took an interest in me. But I didn't know any contemporary music. I didn't really know any classical music. I have such a vivid memory of pulling the Kronos Quartet CD out of the library, and there was that Black Angels by George Crumb came out, and I was like, what is this? This is crazy sounding. You know, so I think I spent a lot of that time sort of digesting contemporary music, classical music, all of it. And then really only years later, I think probably through the process of hearing music that was influenced. I mean, you listen to Steve Reich, you listen to Philip Glass, and you're like, oh, these guys were engaged with popular music as well. And so through that, I was able to then come back to my own interests in pop music that now, you know, are just as much as classical. And, you know, hearing Bjork, hearing you know, Aphex Twin, this music that's really influential on me. It took me a while to get back to the point that I listened to the thing that I liked in high school.
Well, last kind of thing in this kind of bubble of your generation type of thing, but when you went to school and when you were studying composition as you took, you weren't in an atmosphere as it was in the 70s. I was right at the end of that. So,
right.
But there was a dogma, there was a process put on you, there was a push to compose in a certain way. You guys had wide open field. So as you now become these mature artists who are going to shape things and sort of push things in certain directions,
mm-hmm.
I mean, is there a collective of idea that you think music will go this way, or is it just going to stay wide open and eclectic? I mean, you studied in that kind of eclectic anything.
Yeah,
kind of
it's interesting. I feel like I've never thought of it particularly. I mean, I have my preferences, don't get me wrong. I'm not just like anything goes. But I think my preferences run across genres in general. And I think that that's kind of like a played out idea at this point, that everything's cross-genre or whatever. But I do think that goodness, like quality, is a very tangible. I mean, it's not as, to me, as open as some people might have it. I mean, I'm like, how is a piece put together? Like, how does this thing sound beginning to end?
Yeah.
Does it make sense? Does it have its own internal logic? I'm pretty intense about how that is. And so therefore, to me, it's like, how is the piece made? I don't care if it's atonal or tonal, if the piece is really well made, if it makes sense from beginning to end, if the author's intent is there,
right,
then I like it. And I think that that feels like a criterion that can be applied to almost anything.
Yeah, I don't see a lot coming out of composers in your age group that embraces many of the conceptual ideas of 20, 30 years ago. It's hard to kind of put into words, but I mean, and there is this thing for music that has some kind of narrative and coherence, and an audience can grasp
conceptual, like what, like Alvin Lucier, or like
Pauline Alvarez, all these type of people. This conceptual, just
I mean, there is something, you know, those pieces are really special, and I feel that I've done my best to absorb what I can from them.
Yeah,
I mean, there are definitely people doing like piece of paper pieces that are like, do this for an hour.
And, yeah, yeah.
But it's definitely, it doesn't feel at the forefront of the culture at the moment, no.
Right. Music for percussion, quartet, and voice here. The opening minutes from my guest Christopher Cerrone's Goldbeater's Skin, commissioned by Elizabeth and Justice Schlichting and the University of Notre Dame's DeBartolo Performing Arts Center. This, the world premiere performance by Third Coast Percussion and Rachel Calloway. from what you've just talked about, the fact that you've got a lot of notoriety for a work you did in Los Angeles, which was an opera. Mm-hmm. I don't hear anything in your background that screams you would go to an opera. And also, you're trying to redefine it. This thing kind of redefines opera.
Yeah,
one of the headlines in LA is this the future?
Yeah.
So, talk about the piece first, and then talk about...
I mean, my father is like an Italian immigrant who loves opera, so...
Okay. You had it in the house.
It was definitely in the house, but in a way that I actually hated. And it's weird because now I have a super soft spot for, cheesy three-tenor stuff. Because that's what he loves.
But, I just got a CD in the mail called 10 Tenors the other day.
Oh, my God. And there's the three Irish tenors.
They're multiplying.
No, I mean, I have an incredible soft spot for Italian, for Verismo, for Verdi, for Puccini, which I love. But, yeah, I mean, I think I came to opera so ridiculously naively that I didn't even know. I had become obsessed with Calvino, Italo Calvino, and his books, and written a bunch of pieces on him, and decided... You know, obviously the imagery in his books are so wildly brilliant and the words are so lyrically gorgeous that I was like, hey, I should make an opera out of this. You know, my idea for what opera was, the combination of visual art and theater and music and drama and singing. And so, you know, I was like, of course this should be an opera. And I don't think I was thinking about it. I mean, I have like a really specific operatic history that I adore. You know, and I was always kind of obsessed with the voice and opera, and it's a very specific path. You know, my favorite operas are like Bluebeard's Castle by Bartok, or Ravel's L'Enfant et le Sortilège, or Britten's Curlew River. And the thing you'll notice about all these pieces are they're kind of static, and they're like an hour long, and they're very psychological. And so, you know, basically the piece I built, Invisible Cities, was built out of the inspiration of these kinds of works.
Yeah, but not on a static stage.
Well, you know, the thing was that, so, you know, I was saying that I was influenced by these things, and I had this idea that opera was that. And, you know, I was lucky enough to meet Yuval Sharon, who directed the piece in L.A., and basically has a similar idea of that is what opera is. You know, it doesn't have to be this, what I call slowed down play with singing, you know what I mean? And that's, you know, what a lot of opera can be, is just, that's the conceit. Slowed down drama with singing. And to me, it was like, no, this is like art. This is an installation. This is, you know, and, you know, so I happened to meet a collaborator who had a similar idea of what opera could be. And I got very lucky in that regard. And I knew that I wanted an unconventional staging, and I knew I wanted electronics involved, and I wanted amplification. And, you know, I didn't quite know how to accomplish it. So then Yuval came to me and said, let's do it. But I also knew the work was not going to happen on stage. It didn't make any sense to be done on a stage while watched. We tried it while I was in grad school, and it was not successful, in my opinion, but I really believed in the work. Yeah. And so, you know, when Yuval suggested we do it in the train station with headphones, I was like, oh, this is perfect. I can do all the stuff I want with electronics and mixing. We don't have to be stressed out about, like, does this work on stage? Instead, it works as an environment. And, I mean, there were a million and a half decisions made after that. But the basic conceit was, you know, he called me and, you know, we knew each other already. And it was done in one phone call.
So a lot of public pieces have been done. We mentioned David Lang has done a bunch. We mentioned, you know, somebody you studied with. And there's pop-up things and all this kind of stuff. But take us through, this is done in Union Station, Los Angeles. You have no control over what else is happening around those that are participating in the opera. They're having headphones. You had to reset, calibrate some of the frequencies to make sure it could get in so it wouldn't be blocked by train calls.
Oh my God, there was a football game.
Police. And
the football game was a big problem. God. You're reminding me of all like the not fun parts of the opera that I blocked out. And I just like have a fond memory of a perfect performance.
Take us through some of the things that just logically, put aside the music experience of it, that you had to deal with, putting this on in a public space where the majority of the people around are not part of this, they're experiencing it.
You know, you've all described the experience perfect to me. It was that, you know, he wanted to do it. He took a recording of the opera, sat in the train station and just watched the people walk by, and that was enough for him. And I was like, this is perfect, and this is how I live my life so often. You know, I'm always have a pair of headphones on as I walk around the city, so... It seemed like such a perfectly natural extension of what we all do already.
And
it was interesting, you know. If you watch the film, and just, you know, the DVD that was released of it, it's so narrative compared to the actual experience of... I remember my favorite thing was that Thomas Addis came to the opera, and instead of walking around, he just sat at a bar and drank a martini and listened the whole time. But, you know, I loved it. And to me, the thing that made that work particularly successful, in my opinion, out of... You know, I have enormous admiration for... what Yuval's done with all the stagings, but the work had a very fixed soundtrack and a very variable visual scape. And I think that's what made it so successful, is that it always sounded the same, but what you saw was different. And so, like, it wasn't chaos. It was a perfect, to my mind, merging of indeterminacy and determinacy.
You got feedback, obviously, but is there something that was really striking about somebody who was not planning on seeing or being around an opera that day as they went to the train station?
Oh, yeah, that was so cool.
And then, because that's what you want, is you want it to be interactive for the point that those experiencing it are not a static audience in the seat.
And I think there's something about your ego that you just have to let go of, ideally, and that you're like, well, this wasn't exactly how I thought of it, but it's such a cool thing, and, you know, and I can always make the recording later, and people can listen to the perfect version later, but right. This is really... I have always, you know, I feel like when I talk to young composers, I'm like, you don't know what's going to happen. You just give it a, I mean, like, try it, you know?
Right.
And so that was kind of how I felt with that piece. I was like, well, try it. You know, worst case scenario, everyone hates it. It's not like anyone else was producing the piece anyway, so...
Would you do something like this again? Would you recommend this to another composer to try?
I mean, it's interesting because I'm doing a second opera now, and I feel like I'm trying to combine aspects of that work with a more traditionally staged drama, in that I love the immersive elements, and I also want the psychological elements of a traditional opera, and I'm trying to merge the two together as we speak.
From the recording of my guest's opera Invisible Cities, based on the novel by Italo Calvino, setting a conversation between the great explorer Marco Polo and the ruler Kublai Khan, these are the opening minutes from the third scene titled Language, music by my guest today, Christopher Cerrone.
Heady things coming up, and before I turn the microphone on, you were on the phone with the soloist for your upcoming, speaking of another traditional genre piece, a violin concerto.
Yeah.
Talk about the piece, how is it not traditional, and you were talking with the soloist Jennifer Coe, great violinist, past Cadenza guest from years ago, and talk about the piece, but then also your conversation was interesting, again, as before we turn the microphones on, because you're trying to solve problems between a soloist who is known for championing new works, playing with an orchestra that is, you know, a great American orchestra, but are entrenched in maybe not the latest new music language. So,
yeah, and I think it has everything to do with how information is communicated. And this to me is, I definitely don't have an answer to this question, but it's what I'm grappling with right now is that, you know, up until now, a lot of my collaborative relationships have been built on people I know really well and working with them time and time again. And Jenny is someone who I do know quite well. We've already worked together. I wrote her a short violin piece last year, or 2 years ago, and that's how this concerto came about. But the fact of the matter is, learning how to communicate with an orchestra who you have very little rehearsal time with is kind of a classic grappling that a composer does. And so she's like, I want to make sure that, you know, when the first violinists look at this part, they kind of know exactly what to do as quickly as possible. Because it's, you know, it's like $1,000 a minute to rehearse with an orchestra. Right. It's like insane. And so she's totally right. It's hard because you're used to kind of a new music type player who's like, understands the timbral language you're looking to work with. And for me, a big part of what my music is, how my music attempts to be new, is to create a new timbral language.
Right.
So, you know, they see a tremolo and it can't just be a regular tremolo. You have to put your bow all the way up on the tasto. How do you say this? The fingerboard, rather.
Fingerboard, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And really float on. And so it's all about finding ways to communicate with a very old behemoth how to do something different.
Well, besides the soloist and what Jennifer has to put up with, what about this concerto is very conservative and new? I mean, are all the sounds coming from just the instruments in the orchestra? Is it laid out in movements? How does this...
There's no electronics. There is quite a bit of spatializing of players so that there's antiphony in the orchestra. And one of the first things, you know, that Jenny, you know, she's been playing with orchestra since she was 11 years old and performing a ton of concerti. And the first thing she stressed to me when we met up was like, do not over orchestrate this. A violin is not that loud. You've heard a million recordings where there's a mic right on the violin.
Right.
And it sounds really loud, but at the end of the day, it's this little tiny thing, and it's got to project over like 50, 60 other instruments. And so the orchestra I chose, Detroit was kind enough to offer me a very large orchestra, and I chose a very small orchestra. I chose less than wings and twos, you know, two flutes, one oboe, two clarinets, one bassoon, two trumpets, horns, and strings. But the thing that's different is that there's a big, huge amount of percussion in the piece, and percussion, which is very dear to my heart as a composer, plays a very large role in this piece. So it's really Jenny, and then there's these three percussionists play stage left, stage right, and in the back. The sounds are constantly ping-ponging between her and those three players, and that forms a big core of the piece. So I was hopefully able trying to create a sound world which was far more dominated by struck sounds than a traditional orchestra would be.
Leonard Slatkin's conducting, correct?
He is.
Okay.
It's crazy.
You ever worked with him before?
No.
Okay. When you have something like this, there's a build-up, there's an anticipation, you're working through the things now with the soloist.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a dumb question, but on the other side, what are you hoping a big piece like this in a major market, it's going to get some press, da-da-da-da-da.
Mm.
What are you hoping for as a composer on the other end of it?
You know, I have to be honest in that I don't actually like that many violin concerti. I love hearing Jenny play, and she's an amazing violinist, but there are a few violin concerti that are very dear to my heart, and there's a lot that are not.
Yeah.
And I am not interested in virtuosity particularly. And what is like a concerto but someone showing off? And to me, I think the thing I was trying to accomplish with this piece was, how do I find a way to put this person in the front, have her be the musical heart of the piece, while not have it be about showing off? And I think I accomplished that in quite a few different ways. Part of it is just giving her really lyrical playing to do. You know, just like the whole first movement is like footballs. It's whole notes, you know. And she's soaring above the orchestra. And that's one way that I'm like, it's not virtuosic in the sense that it's a million notes, but it's incredibly hard to play a perfect, beautiful melody over an orchestra, you know, and play perfectly in tune and expressively. And so there's that challenge. Part of the piece is like, something I noticed about Jenny is that she's an incredibly passionate player. And so I remember one of the first times she invited me to go see her play, and I noticed that she basically used up about half of her bow shredding a piece, you know, because she's such a passionate player. So part of the piece is about giving her that kind of energy. And so, like, you know, I love the idea of virtuosity as energy. And so she's generating just a ton of energy with her movement. And so there's a constant back and forth every beat between her and the orchestra. And so it's like, you know, in a sense, I found a way to have this very traditional thing, the trade-off and fast playing, but have it be also something that I found to be really musically exciting. And then part of the piece is, you know, there's a sort of big central movement. It's in seven movements, seven short movements. But the central movement is about 5.5 minutes long, and it's the emotional core of the work. And that is, you know, all about just giving her sort of every different way that she could generate some kind of lyrical playing. And so I think the piece is about lyrical playing. It's about energy, sort of very rhythmic, you know, hoedown playing. And Yeah, my goal was to create a concerto that was virtuosic without just seeming like someone showing off, or rather that she's the essence. She generates the piece, in a sense.
Whether you call them by name or not, but do these type of traditional genres and forms, symphonies, string quartet, I mean, do those hold an interest to you to create something of your own creation inside that type of genre?
Yeah, I think so. I think that concerto sort of remains sort of an interesting genre that has survived better than almost any others from the classical era, because I think it's not really a form, it's just the idea of writing something for a soloist and a group. That seems totally appealing, because I think it's a very humanistic thing, and I think it's more appealing to me to write a concerto than just a straight orchestra piece per se, because it's about communication, and to me music is about very real kinds of communication, and the fact that I can collaborate so closely with Jenny and come up with all these things feels really fun and really human and sort of in the line of how I like to make music, which is
right. Communicating.
So in that regard, it's like sort of like the orchestra, which is always this abstract entity of people who are judging you, you know, about your parts. You have a comrade on the line, and also it's very musically centering, so that I can build this piece around someone and use the orchestra as a way of sort of her being in dialogue with the orchestra. It feels like it's a form that's lasted for a reason. You know, I will say that the most classical things are the things that terrify me the most. Like, you asked me to write you a percussion quartet or a piece for electronics or like whatever, and I'm like down. I wrote my first string quartet this year. That was a real challenge, you know, and I feel like in a weird sense, it began as a percussion, I mean, not literally, but I, you know, a lot of the ideas were generated almost as if they were percussion instruments, and I had to find my way into them as string instruments. It literally begins with a tapping on all parts of the strings, and finally they start bowing, and in that regard, but it also, it becomes a really fun challenge. I mean, I don't think I want to have a career where I only write string quartets or orchestra pieces, and I don't think I'd want to have a career where I'd never tried to do something interesting in that idiom.
No, and you've already written for voice, so that doesn't hold. I mean, some composers hold off from that.
No, voice is like my jam.
So there's a comfort zone there.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there's a comfort zone where I could write song cycles for the rest of my life and be totally fine.
So here's some music my guest Christopher Cerrone has composed for violin, commissioned by the Frome Music Foundation at Harvard University for Rachel Lee Pride, violinist, and David Kaplan, piano, the closing minutes of my guest's violin sonata.
Things again, go back. We were talking about the beginning about generating music, and explain to our audience what Sleeping Giant is.
Oh, Sleeping Giant. Sleeping Giant is the product of a weekend in the Adirondacks. Really, you know, six composers. We are a collective. We are. I think you had Ted Hearn on the show too, right?
Ted Hearn was a few weeks back. Yep.
Yeah. It's six of us: Andrew Norman, Ted Hearn, Tim O'Andrus, Rob Honstein, Jacob Cooper, and myself.
Yeah, Tim was on years ago, too. Yeah.
Oh, cool. And we all were at Yale at the same time. And I think the group sort of formed out of a combination of friendship and mutual admiration more than some kind of aesthetic vision.
Okay.
And we were literally at Rob Hohnstein's house in the Adirondacks, and I was like, hey guys, let's do a concert. That'd be fun. And that was sort of all I thought of at the time. And then, you know, people are like, what are you called? And we're like, we have to have a name, you know, and ultimately wound up giving a name, which was a playful homage to one of our teachers, Ingram Marshall, who's one of my favorite people in the world and kind of a spiritual guru for the group. And he used to go mushroom hunting in Sleeping Giant State Park in Hampton, Connecticut. So we all liked the name. And so we started doing concerts together, and then we did one concert and another, and then groups started approaching us. They're like, well, do you want to write us a piece? And we're like, well, how do we do that? And sort of came across the challenge of writing compositions for people as a group of six composers, which is difficult and email-laden process.
Yeah, but I mean, we were talking about, you know, Paris and Berlin. I mean, they didn't do it often, but I mean, one thinks of like Les Six. And they did collaborate on pieces.
Yeah, totally.
And so this is something, like you said, you're not trying to push a certain agenda, but these are six of you that obviously find common ground in some way to be able to work together without competition, without, you know, trying to one-up one another or anything like that.
Well, I think it's like a born of mutual respect. Something that I feel maybe is genuinely true about our generation is that it feels like we're not so in competition with one another. I mean, Don't get me wrong, we all feel competitive in general, and you know, it's a hard field to work in, but with those people I don't feel competitive, and I'm so happy whenever something good happens to one of them, you know. And I feel that aesthetically it's so at the core of what I'm doing is my relationship with these composers, and the fact that we all, you know, toss ideas back and forth, and we show each other our music, we show scores. I mean, composing is really lonely. It's either lonely or desperately social in an intense way, but there's very little in between. And so, you know, I think it was a chance for us as composers to have colleagues who we believe in and form a community with. And all the performers that we've collaborated with and other composers we worked with, because we've done a project recently, we've sort of brought some other composers in. It's all about forming a community and, you know, forming relationships.
Yeah, I think it's really healthy and I think it's very cool. I mean, again, we were talking about earlier in New York, you had a split up downtown. You have all these divides and all these isms and processes and ways of composing, and here you guys are banding together and your music does sound very different from one another.
Yeah.
And I think it's very cool. So, you know, a good way. Do you want to mention Red Light new music too? Because that sort of moves
Red Light
out.
Was the predecessor to Sleeping Giant.
Okay.
And it's no longer together, but it was a earlier collective that I formed, and we had an ensemble, and I think it's defunct now officially, but it was the predecessor. One person who I was in the group was a composer named Scott Wolschlager, who I is still a very close friend of mine. And he's actually now working with members of Sleeping Giant on a new project. So, you know, I suck everyone back in.
Sleeping Giant can't grow, correct?
Sleeping Giant, no one knows what Sleeping Giant is. It could be anything we wanted. There's a project right now that's premiering in a couple of days in Portland, wherein it's half of Sleeping Giant, or two-thirds of Sleeping Giant. So it's Ted, Rob, Jacob, and I are involved with the project. And then we also involved Scott Wolschlager,
right,
and a composer named LJ White, who was in Chicago, now in St. Louis. We like the idea that it's a core group, but a lot of different collaborations can happen in the context of that group.
Here's the esteemed contemporary ensemble Eighth Blackbird in the final minutes of my guest Christopher Cerrone's work called South Catalina, inspired by a painting belonging to the Maxine and Stuart Franklin Foundation for Art.
Thank you.
seems like, well, the violin concerto, which is coming up soon, probably is the biggest thing in front of your eyes. But can you talk about anything else down the line? I mean, some things I know, maybe some, you know, things have to be signed and approved. But some composers are superstitious. But talk about some other things.
Well, I just last week had a portrait concert at Miller Theater, which was an hour of my music for percussion and or voice. No, percussion and voice.
It almost seems like a rite of passage to have the portrait thing at Miller Theater in New York.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so funny because I have to say that it sort of like took an outside level of hugeness. I think anything that you see in your childhood or your youth feels very big. But I remember, you know, I was at the Manhattan School and I would see these Miller Theater portrait concerts. And they were actually one of the biggest ways I first started seeing new music in New York, you know, when I was at the Manhattan School. And I think at the time, George Steele was in charge of Miller Theater. And that was so... I saw Alarm Will Sound for the first time. I saw Julie Wolfe's music for the first time. And now under the stewardship of Melissa Smay, it's like such a great series and continues to be really... But, you know, as an 18-year-old, that was huge for me, and, you know, to have a concert there. And so that was really fabulous. And Third Coast Percussion, the quartet, who performed all my music, joined by the mezzo Rachel Calloway for a new piece called Goldbeater Skin that I wrote for all of them. And yeah, it was really fun. It felt really nice. It was the opposite of Violin Concerto Land in that it was all percussion. It was all amplified. It was all sound designed, and I had lighting design, and so that was, you know, the sort of other end of what I do, closer on some level to Invisible Cities. But yeah, I think the navigating these different worlds is really fun and challenging for me. What's up next? I'm writing a lot of orchestra music these days. I gotta say, it's like maybe it's a natural outgrowth of a composer's career, but right after this I will be starting a new piece for the LA Phil. And the LA Phil premiered in November. That's announced, so I can say that
that's with Dudamel.
It's not with Dudamel, it's a conductor named Roderick Cox, who I haven't met yet. Okay. I think he's the assistant conductor at the Minnesota Orchestra, I want to say.
Okay.
I haven't met him yet, but he's supposed to be really fabulous. Okay. Everything else, what else can I say? I don't know what else is announced yet or not, so maybe...
Okay. Yeah, I know.
But yeah, there's quite a lot brewing at the moment.
Yeah, well, I wish you continued success. I think the music's great, and, you know, like I said, there's so much energy coming out of the strata,
I'm trying.
I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been doing, but with someone from the past. You never had a chance to. When I ask that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely Stravinsky.
It'd be Stravinsky.
Definitely.
Okay. Difficult conversation, possibly.
Well, who wants to have an easy conversation? I just think that Stravinsky is a genius in a way that I can't even fathom. You know, his music is so genius to me in a way that it's not the way my brain works. I mean, it's funny listen to Stravinsky so long now, and there's, you know, that little drawing where it's like my music and it's this weird line with like different dots on it and it goes in different directions, and somehow it finally made sense to me recently. But you know, if I could have any access to his brain, I would be very pleased to.
We talked about your age group, and as you move into two decades from now and, you know, four decades, I mean, Stravinsky changed, and he led the change, sometimes he followed the change, but he changed his style. I mean, do you see that as a possibility as things go, or?
Yeah, I would love that. I feel like there's something about my music that feels very my music in a way that it feels fairly consistent, and I don't really know why that is. I think on some level, my music is a reaction to all the music I've hated my whole life, or as much as it is the music I've loved. And so the thing I think I'm most concerned about is that as a composer, you are given a gift when you get to have people listen to your music. It's not a presumption. It's a huge gift. And the idea that someone is taking their time out of their life, wherein, you know, it's not that much time in life to enjoy music.
Yeah.
If they're giving you that gift, then I want to make good use of the person's time, which is not to pander, but just to write something that where every minute felt salient. And so I think I could see myself doing that in a lot of ways, but I can't imagine myself not doing that.
No, there's a care involved there. Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. Extremely busy. When you have to do something non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, respite.
I don't understand what any of these words mean. No, I'm
you're
kidding.
Totally consumed.
I love to cook. I come from a very large Italian family, and I lived in Rome. So, you know, I think I'm always thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner. You know, it feels to me very edifying to at least be able to make a good meal, even if you didn't write a good concerto that day.
Yeah.
I love to bike. I'm an avid biker. You can see the bike racks here.
Yeah.
Around Brooklyn. That's in Brooklyn. Is much better to bike in than Manhattan as well. It's another reason to be a composer in Brooklyn, is you can bike here. And I love to read, you know, obviously. And yeah, I guess other than that, I'm pretty boring, you know. My music is consumes too much of my life.
Well, wish you continued success and keep stuff coming.
I'm trying.
Christopher Cerrone, thanks.
Thank you.
Composer Christopher Cerrone. You can find out more about him at his website, ChristopherCerrone.com. His violin concerto with soloist Jennifer Coe and the Detroit Symphony Orchestra led by Leonard Slatkin premieres on May 25th. I'll leave you with the closing minutes from a work commissioned from my guest by the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, here performed by them under the direction of Jeffrey Kahane. The work titled There Will Be Singing. In a world where young creators such as my guest don't envision themselves making political statements, it is, it seems, hard to avoid. This work takes its title from words of Bertolt Brecht. In the dark times, will there be singing? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. Music by my guest today, Christopher Cerrone, and as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.